Today I have with me Mark Dancy. Mark studied industrial design at the Adelaide School of the Arts, has managed several commercial businesses, and was also CEO of a regional public housing company in Australia. He's recognized as a world-renowned evaluator of energy technologies and is currently helping develop several new energy concepts himself. Over the last 7 years, Mark has traveled the world evaluating many new and free energy claims. He specializes in magnetic motor and HHO gas evaluations, but has reviewed many other technologies. He has been featured as a speaker at several energy conferences, and his catch cry is "Show me the data," as he is a believer in scientific methodology when evaluating claims. Mark, thank you for being with me today.
No problems. My pleasure.
First off, can you provide the audience with a bit more information about your background, your credentials, and how you got interested in the topic of breakthrough energy?
Somewhere amongst all that, I spent about 10 years managing several divisions of a university, mainly commercial arm. I was looking after IT, their internet company, reprographics, and I was involved in industrial relations. So I did about 10 years. I was on a lot of the management boards and committees, so I had quite a bit of exposure to academic life. And the final job I was doing, or enterprise I was involved in, I was teaching currency trading, the ultimate form of capitalism. You know, you sell money and profit off money itself, back in the mid, probably about 2004 or 5, somewhere around there. And that leads me up to the story I've told many times, what got me started on this. And it was my eldest daughter, who's probably about 12 at the time, maybe 13, and I think she just completed a school project, suddenly become aware of how bad the environment is, how bad everything is. So we're at our summer vacation at a beach where we used to camp down by a river and a beach for a couple of weeks every year. She can't recall this, but it changed my life, so I recall it very, very well. And she said, "Your generation has left this legacy of inequality, pollution, environmental damage." And she's really sort of pointing at me at the time, saying, "It's not what your generation's going to do to fix it. What are you going to do personally?" And that started my journey. And believe it or not, within 3 weeks of that conversation, I was no longer currency trading or teaching currency trading. I ended up in Texas from Australia testing HHO systems. So that was the start of my journey in exploring energy technologies. And from there, it just expanded that. The network grew bigger and bigger of people I met along the way, and just trying to find out, is there something there? Do magnetic motors work? Does this technology work? Is that claim credible? And I started off with HHO, water cars, expanded into magnetic motors, gravity machines, just about everything that covers what you would call the free energy spectrum.
Would you mind telling us more about your company Infinergy as well as your website Revolution Green?
Well, Revolution Green is actually Ken LeBurns. He's in Utah, and Simon, him, and Chris, and a few of us got together, and my good wife, Haley. And Ken had established a site, and he just wanted an alternative voice. It seemed to be only one or two sites that were dealing with free energy, and he just wanted something that allowed people without censorship to speak and allow scientific discussions to take place and allow credible evaluations of technologies, and also to help people with information, you know, how to measure things and what was happening, not just in the free energy, but what major milestones are being achieved with battery technology, electric cars, anything that was going to get us away from fossil fuels, give us energy independence if possible, so we're not economically tied down, and assist the environment. So I volunteered. It is a voluntary group that I'll throw a few stories up there. And from that, it's sort of grown to, I haven't had much time on the site the last 2 weeks because I've been busy with another project, but it's sort of grown into building up this enormous network of people and individuals around the world, not just our readers, but people who are investors, seeking, you know, what are the best devices to go where the risk is the lowest. Inventors, we get a lot of inventors contacting us, and we put them in contact with people that can help them. This whole network's developing, and it's all about finding the truth. We're about saying, okay, it's no good pursuing a dead end. You know, it's a waste of time, money, and resources. What are the truth, or what are the promising signs that something is worthwhile pursuing? It may be show me the data, but the data's going to not always be conclusive and saying yes or no. It might sometimes say this is an area worthwhile investigating. And I guess that's what we're all about. What we don't want to do is waste time or provide platforms for scam artists, for people who just want to profit off others, for people who've even got other agendas. I found in this industry, if you like, a lot of people have actually got other agendas and they want to use free energy for their actual other political agenda or religious agenda. So this big, massive melting pot of ideologies, ideas, and I guess we're focusing on the science, because if we can deal with what's real, what can be repeatable, you know, what can be done by others, that's what we're aiming to do with Revolution Green. Infinergy was an R&D company initially set up, and we were doing R&D on several areas, not just free energy, but energy related. And it was a coming together of different scientists and technicians and people. But we sort of evolved and gone different directions now. But one thing we did discover, finding funding for R&D is very, very hard, especially when, you know, there hasn't been a great success rate. So my focus at the moment and some of the others is to develop an enterprise that can fund such a research. So we're not dependent on going to vice, so venture capitalists, the market or rich people or angel investors. We can actually do something, generate income, and support those projects without having to put the hand out. And that gives us a lot of independence on what we're doing. So I guess we've taken two steps forward, one step back, and we're putting the foundations in place to move forward. And as a result, the Infinergy Labs is the partners in it. We're still partners in different enterprises. Some are working in Utah still. Some are working in Colorado. I'm working here. So we've got the network, but we're all just working on different projects in different locations, if that makes any sense.
Now, why have you personally come to believe that quote-unquote free energy is a legitimate phenomenon? And what do you think are the most demonstrable or near-proven exotic energy technologies currently in existence?
Well, I can speak for myself and many other people who haven't got a public profile, who have traveled the world many times over investigating these projects. And I'm talking about a group of people. Some are self-funded, some have spent years and hundreds of thousands of dollars. Myself, some years, I think the most flights, I did 42 flights one year, 22 internationals investigating these. I was self-funded at the time. Sometimes I get paid by potential investors to come and check a technology. But what we come across, and a lot of people say, I'm a skeptic and I'm negative, I'm actually not. I'm very open-minded, and so are most of my friends. We wouldn't be looking if we didn't believe there's some possibilities out there. And we've come across, but where we've come, quote, skeptics, it's like becoming a skeptic by default, that if you've seen 50 magnetic motors or you know of about 90 that your friends might have seen, and none of them can do what they say they do, and I've seen people spend hundreds of thousands of dollars, in fact, blow millions on magnetic motors, on gravity energy, on PAP technology, on plasma, a whole array of technologies. And you start going, okay, you know, when you've blown a few bucks, you've backed a few inventors, you become a skeptic by default. Not that we're set out to be skeptics, but when you haven't seen any evidence to date that none of the claims can be met, and you've seen a lot of scam artists along the way, you start getting very, I don't know, you're open-minded, but you question, definitely question, because we want to find the truth. So if I take you through a list of fields, one of the most common ones I've seen is what I think is called cumogens now. I think somebody's coined a term, is where they put a motor and a generator together, electric motor and electrical generator. And there's always a battery in the system. And I've seen many of these devices worldwide. My friends have seen many, and I've also dealt with many of the inventors. And at times they appear to be self-running, but they're not. And they're being fooled, or they're just, in most cases, just miscalculations. They're using, say, a battery in the system. And what they're actually doing is changing the topography of the battery. They're changing the characteristics of the battery, and it's just fooling them for a while until the battery collapses. Or they're using a flywheel and actually drawing down on stored energy. And in every case I've ever seen, it's just a matter of miscalculation, or it just hasn't happened. Magnetic motors are the same. And I've even backed a few projects and even work with people today advising them and putting them in contact with some engineers. People are still trying to get the magnetic motors, and I haven't seen one to date that is self-running or can produce any excess energy. We're not saying it's not possible, even though we know the laws of physics saying it's not possible. We just haven't seen any to date. HHO was an interesting one, and I was fortunate over a two-year period to have a company back some tests, and we use national labs in Australia, government-backed labs in America, private labs. We spend hundreds of thousands of dollars testing a variety of HHO devices and other things like water injection and alcohol injection, and we just wanted to get to the truth of what it really does and what are the benefits of it. And it does. It does have some benefits, and it does do certain things, and in some countries. So there's a whole myriad of technologies we've been looking at and working our way through over the years. There's probably just a handful that I believe that are worthwhile pursuing in the future. In fact, I'm working on an enterprise at the moment where we're producing an energy form that will assist people, especially in third world countries, to reduce their energy costs. But it's not free energy, but that will fund future energy research. And my intention next year, maybe the year after, is build another lab, and we'll do some serious research into some of the things we did find that are worthwhile pursuing. And they're mainly in the areas of thermoelectrics and some other little anomalies we found along the way with nuclear spin, piezoelectrics, a few other things. Perhaps it might be better if you ask me specific technologies and I can give you a quote on our experience, our observations, and where I think they're headed.
Well, you've mentioned in a prior talk you see some relevance in solid-state devices that either collect ambient electrons or, who knows, ambient something. What do you think the value is in that, and why do you think those are a possible free energy technology for the future?
That area intrigues me because we found one technology with that where we can extract the ambient energy, which is the heat energy from the atmosphere. And there's a lot of devices and a lot of breakthroughs and a lot of developments in those areas that's coming along quite well. The other one is in that solid state area, there's one that it just makes sense. One example has been developed and demonstrated, but no further research has been done there. And this is all low energy outputs, but here's the number one question we ask ourselves always when we're evaluating technology. Where does the energy come from? You have to ask where the energy comes from because, you know, solar, we've got the sun. Wind, you've got the wind. Ocean, you've got the waves. Thermoelectric, of course, you've got heat. But what we really need to do is we really need to ask that question. That's the first question we ask. So with the thermoelectric or solid-state devices, one thing's still puzzling us. There was one device we had that appeared we couldn't explain where the energy was coming from. It was coming from the vacuum. It was coming from anywhere else. But subsequently, we found it was just the modification of the material and the material itself readjusting itself over a long period of time was creating the energy. And when I hear the people saying zero point energy or energy from the vacuum, zero point means the lowest energy state that exists in the universe. And half the universe may consist of this dark matter, this energy source and whatever, but we really, really have to look at how dense is it? I'll give an example. On a hot sunny day, you get a lot of sunshine shining on a solar cell. You get a lot of energy, a lot of electricity. Okay. At night time, you get hardly anything. Well, the zero point energy is spread over such a wide area of the universe that it is a bit like a solar cell operating at night time. The energy is there. We believe it's there, but it's hard to detect. And there's been some very major scientific research projects to try and detect it, but it's spread that thin that you need a big volume of space to actually extract any usable energy. However, we do believe that a couple of little quirks in nature, and we're going to talk about LNER a little bit later, but there are a couple of quirks in nature that I want to investigate further. And one of them is what we call nuclear spin technology, where certain materials in the presence of magnetic field, the electron spin goes into a wobble, okay? It's just a straightforward science thing. They use it in MRI scanning, that principle. But if you put a piezoelectric material with it, you suddenly get an interaction with a piezo material and it generates electricity. That's never really been fully developed and explored, and we can explain where the energy is coming from in that process. But what we don't know is how much, you know, we can do very thin film atomic layer deposition technology. We don't understand how much energy we can actually generate, and can we, like, get a device the size of a credit card and do 1 watt, or can we get a device the size of a credit card and only do a nanowatt? We don't know those answers yet, and that's the area I'm going to be exploring in the future, very much so. And same as thermoelectrics, we found certain materials, and you'll read about this in the science papers quite a bit lately, they're making leaps and bounds that the amount of energy they can extract from the environment with thermoelectric materials is, you know, it's a bit like the early days of solar energy. They're very inefficient, but now they're getting the efficiencies up there. I believe that could be a real potential milestone as far as energy generation goes. Anyway, back to you.
So you did just bring this up, so we'll just jump right into it. What do you think of cold fusion or low energy nuclear reactions generally? And what are your thoughts about recent commercial developments in the field specifically?
Right. I've been maintaining a pretty steady view on this for some years now, that there are some clear phenomena demonstrated. Blacklight Power, I think is Cornell University or somewhere, some university. You can sometimes demonstrate a phenomenon that's there. It might be, we can't explain this chemically, we can't explain it that way. There's an event. The trouble is they're events. And the problem they're going to have is engineering that event into a useful commercial form of energy that is commercially viable. So you've had companies like Blacklight Power been around, spent millions and millions of dollars, full of promise, but they've yet to demonstrate. They can demonstrate the event, but they cannot demonstrate the engineering side of it. Like, how do you put in a continuous process? And you've had companies like Brilliant, you know, that they're having troubles with the patent office, I think, now, because certain things haven't been demonstrated. They've been around for a long time. And there is some really good research out of Japan, actually. You know, I've seen some papers recently that most of the time, and this is the other problem, is consistency. So one is the engineering and one is the consistency. Getting consistency. They can 40% or 50% of the time get the event to happen or demonstrate the phenomenon. They don't understand enough about it yet to understand how to make it work every time and what is the phenomenon causing it. And the engineering is just a nightmare. So my view on LNER at this stage, unless there's a major engineering breakthrough or they fully understand it, it might be another decade, 2 decades, I don't think you're going to see anything commercially out there, especially when you look at the alternatives. I'm a great supporter of thorium nuclear energy. All the bad things about normal nuclear energy, thorium doesn't possess. It hasn't got hundreds of thousands of years of half-life. It's got a very short term. It needs to be stored afterwards. It can't go into a meltdown situation like Fukushima. It can't do that. It just stops. It's got a whole lot of positives. And I think things like that will develop much quicker than LNER. And the other reason I believe that too, there's a handful of little companies in the world and a few good scientists working on LNER, but the industry's also got some clowns out there who have got pretty bad track records of their other projects they're working on, and there's a sensationalism around it, and it puts people off, you know, puts people off. But you look at the thorium research, one company alone in China is going to have 750 scientists and technicians working for them. I think they're up to 300 now. They're building reactors. India is aiming for 30% of their energy needs to be thorium. In Scandinavia, around the world, even in America, there's research. So there's a lot more money, time and effort being devoted to energy sources like thorium that will, you know, help power neighborhoods, or might, you know, the ones in America are very small scale, or might help power the world, versus LNER, which really hasn't got the funding. It's got the curiosity of some companies, some universities, some scientists, but I think it's going to be decades before anything really comes out of it, because after 2 decades so far, there's nothing viable that's there. Is it worthwhile pursuing? Absolutely. Is it worthwhile funding? Absolutely. Will anything be at Walmart next year? No. It's a pretty simple process. And I read a lot of papers on LNER. There's a couple of really, really good commentators on the internet with LNER, and there's a lot of good scientists working on LNER. But nobody can get that consistency. Nobody can get that engineering demonstrated as a continuous process.
Digging into thorium just a bit more, why wasn't it used prior? What suddenly happened where thorium became viable?
Back in the late 60s, early 70s, you actually had a thorium reactor quite happily running in America in one of the university's labs. There's two reasons, I think. I think it's all to do with politics and corporate power. The waste isn't good for making nuclear bombs. Okay, so why would you want a reactor you can't go and blow people up with? And secondly, I think the early development of the nuclear industry, they had so much money and resources in the way they're making nuclear energy and the path they'd follow, that this is a real threat to the capital invested. But now, nuclear as we know it has become very unpopular, so now there's a revival of the thorium technology. I think it's all to do with politics and money and capitalism, to tell you the truth, that it never went ahead. But now the money's being poured in there. There are billions or hundreds of millions of dollars being poured into thorium research right now. And it's been proven. It's been proven over and over again. And there's small little reactors running around the world at the moment. And I think you're going to see, probably it might be 3 years, might be 5 years, you're going to see some very commercially viable thorium reactors. Good thing with those, you fire them up, they can run 10, 20, 30 years. You could have a neighborhood one sitting down the corner, you know, it just sits there year after year running and probably needs a bit of maintenance every now and then. But I really believe that, for the reasons that it's been proven in the past, it's a known science, needs a bit of refining. I think that'll go ahead because it's more clear, it's more black and white than, say, LNER, because LNER is still such a grey area. So it's a bit like you look at solar now. In many parts of the world, solar, or my home state in Australia, South Australia, 20% of all households have PV panels. I think 50%, or must be close to it, have solar thermal, you know, for the hot water systems. In some countries, the uptake of these technologies is just massive. You look at Germany, you look at Norway, they're, I think, 90% hydro and wind powered now, and they're running electric cars on it. So I think the alternative energies have got the jump on some of these. And for big energy, you know, doing power plant size stuff, I think thorium's got it over LNER. And I don't think you'll ever see LNER sitting as a little home generator. I think at the best, you'll be looking at hundreds of kilowatt plants, maybe megawatt plants. So it's going to be big guys who come in, fund it, and you'll see that technology being used for big power companies.
Now, besides traditional solar, wind, and even thorium, are there any other, you know, quote-unquote, stepping stone energy options for the near future that you think can either just increase our general efficiency or ultimately help replace what we currently use?
Well, the real key is actually energy storage. And there's $100 billion a year being spent on battery technologies alone. And that's going to be the breakthrough. It's an enabling thing. Now, you just mentioned solar, wind. I could name a few others. They're intermittent. That's the problem. And the cost of storing them, because you need energy maybe when you need it, the sun's not up or the wind's not there. And that's been the problem. They've got cogeneration happening pretty well now. In some states, you've got a windmill and you've got a gas generator working side by side. Up in Canada, I think Minnesota's doing it. You've got hydro working with wind side by side, adjusting the loads and peak. But you need the energy storage. And this is the real key, because it costs so much to store the energy. It costs many times more than that it does to produce energy. And the other enabling thing is, why are we driving gasoline when electric is so much? It's cheaper to build an electric car, except for the cost of the batteries. And it's much more beneficial if you're drawing your energy source from solar or non-carbon sources. So the battery technology, or the energy storage, is really the enabling technology. The other thing that's coming in that's influenced this a little bit, that has happened recently, is some companies, there's bus companies now around the world and electric car companies looking at fast charging. In Sweden, the bus pulls up and, you know, has these two buzz bars, I guess, on top of the bus, they pop up, hit the line, and the bus is recharged in 10 minutes. So that bus doesn't need many batteries, and it can go round and round 24 hours a day. Other companies, Utah University and the companies in California, the airport run at Korea now, they've got coils, if you like, or wires sitting in the road, and when the bus pulls up at a stop, it's recharging using, I won't say wireless because it's not actually wireless, but it's using induction and it's charging these vehicles every time it pulls up a bus stop. Or in the case of Korea, as it's driving along the road, there's a cable in the road and the bus is actually getting recharged when it's driving across that cable. So I think a lot of that technology will come forward in public transport, but the real thing that makes a big difference is, whereas solar, in many countries, including Australia, solar is cheaper than getting the grid connected. Even in the Philippines here, they're aiming for 100% renewable energy within 10 years for the grid. It's all possible. So I see what's the breakthrough coming with the new solar. Solar panels have got that cheap now. You know, they're getting down to 20 or 30 cents a watt to manufacture. You can't get any cheaper than that. Materials cost that. What's the defining factor with solar and wind and all these other things is the battery storage that you need. That's the cost thing. And the prices of that battery storage is coming down at a phenomenal rate. I think with the Tesla cars, the batteries are nearly halved in price in the last 3 years. And I know battery technology is 40 or 50 different ones I'm following at the moment. The cost of storage, and they're using other technology, flywheel storage, but they use on F1 cars and a whole lot of other things coming to play. New capacitors are being developed that I do believe in the next 5 years, that will be the thing that triggers that people then go, aha, I better run an electric car. I've got now 1,000-kilometre range or 1,000-mile range in my car, and it doesn't matter because I can recharge it very quickly, or B, it gets recharged while I'm driving along on certain lanes. So I think those changes are coming. I'm answering this in two parts. So that's part one. Part two, there are a lot of existing technologies, energy technology. I'll give you an example. My focus and my motive is the third world. There's 1.6 billion people without electricity. And they're using kerosene or other liquid petroleum products, all sorts of things, to do lighting. And it costs them a fortune. It can cost up to 20-30% of their wages, their little income. There's over 1.5 million burn victims and problems in India alone a year, let alone the rest of the world. The carbon monoxide for the kids. There's just a pile of health problems. There's fire hazards. People die from using it. They're dependent on the big oil companies to provide this kerosene. So there are a lot of technologies out there. Now, a common one that's happening now is little rechargeable solar lights they're using. So they're buying those. And they cost a fraction to run, and different companies and charities are helping provide them. We're working on one now that uses a metal and water, and the running cost is 90% less than the kerosene, and there's no pollution, no evil products. If you like, a flashlight without batteries, a radio or a house light that doesn't require batteries requires a little bit of seawater, and every 1,000 hours or so requires a little replacement rod that costs a fraction of what they're paying now for kerosene and a 1/100th of the cost of the battery. So what I see is these stepping stone technologies. So we can bring what we already know. And this technology, by the way, is being used by military in some countries. There are technologies out there being used by military. They're being used by different applications, by industry. They're in the universities. And it's just a matter of, okay, why don't we apply that to a solution? What's the problem? First look at the problem. Then apply the solution to the problem and say, aha, what if we do use that and use it for this purpose? And that's what it's all about, bringing those relationships, those networks together. So fortunately, I can't say anything publicly yet, but within the next few days, or actually next few weeks, there'll be a lot of product out there that will be putting out. One of our companies, Infinergy, developed the technology. Infinergy will be receiving royalties, which in turn, some of the people in Finergy we use to develop other technologies will be releasing a products for the Western markets and also for the third world so they can do away with this kerosene lighting. And we're just applying existing known science and technology to do this. There's several of them out there. And here's my question back to you. I'd like to answer this. One of the questions that keeps recurring to me, we should get back to free energy, is should we just keep waiting for the free energy solution to come, believing it will, or should we be proactive, bringing about solutions now using technologies that exist? What's your thoughts on that?
Oh, of course we should be proactive, because free energy itself is not well understood enough, as we talked about and as the evidence points to. It's not an engineerable phenomenon through and through to the point where we're heating up people's homes. And we understand that our ecological issues are immediate. I mean, we're talking 20, 30, 40 years when there's going to be hell to pay. So if we don't do something to stop the bleeding, or at least clot it, in the meantime, until we find a more absolute solution, whether that's cold fusion, whether that's thorium, whether that's vacuum energy. So efforts like this are very important. And even the small stuff, even as a proponent of free energy, I would still say, of course, anyone that's doing anything to either increase our efficiency, make what we have better, is absolutely the right track. Because like you said, 1.6 billion people are without electricity around where you are. That's unfathomable. So we need to fix that now, rather than just hoping on a wing and a prayer, I would say.
Yeah, and that's where my journey, why I asked you that question, that's where my journey took me, whereas I honestly believed 6 years ago, I looked at all sorts of technology, Jocells and that, oh, wow, we got solutions here. And then I discovered, no, the solutions aren't here yet. Is it a possibility? Yes, of course. Are some worth pursuing? Of course. I encourage all inventors and people to keep on pursuing with their magnetic motors or their linear research or whatever takes their fancy. I absolutely encourage that and support that. That's why we're doing this. You know, the small profits we'll make out of, we won't make a profit out of the third world, but we'll make a profit out of the Western countries where supplying, you know, you can go and buy a radio from Walmart or a flashlight. You never need batteries again. You just need a bit of water and, you know, a replaceable rod costs you a couple of bucks and lasts you equivalent to 100 batteries. Of course, we'll make some profits on that, but that all gets poured back into supporting those efforts, whatever the research is, supporting the solid state research, supporting that. And I've seen some pretty big projects, like the free energy society is crazy. I mean, what you read about is just scratching the surface, okay? The real big stuff is happening with private investors and some pretty serious attempts. I've seen $5 million spent on a solar motor effort in Asia. And it was good. The information that was obtained from it was useful, but there was no working prototype of it. I know of millions spent on PAP engine technology or plasma engines, and nobody knows about that, literally. There wouldn't be 20 people on the whole planet know about that. Yet what we get to read about is a much publicized cases that sometimes don't bring a lot of credit to that research. And it makes it hard when people, investors and scientists, universities, and see, oh, that's a scam. It makes it really hard for legitimate ones to raise capital. And that's why I sometimes get on my soapbox and I'm pretty critical. If I see a scam or I see something that's not right, I will definitely jump on my soapbox, because it makes it so hard for everybody else if there's no credibility. You know, and people say, oh, you're skeptic. Here's another one. I went to a conference in Holland, the Global BEM conference back a couple of years ago. Sometimes I get stumped and everybody gets stumped. That's what keeps us going. Because when you get stumped and you can't explain something, you know it's worthwhile pursuing. And there's a chap there with a technology and he builds an antenna array. It's just a simple antenna array fit in the size of a light fitting. And I'm using the word antenna array because that's the best way to describe it. It's a few bits of metal tubing put together in a certain way. And his claim to fame is you put that in a room and it dries out the walls. You know, they have a lot of salt damp in wet countries and cold climates in Europe. And it works. I can't deny it, because there's two proofs to me. One, they sold hundreds of millions of dollars worth of these devices. Two, they've been through the courts and pulled over the coals and always survived. Actually, there's four reasons. Three, very reputable institutions, churches, governments and all that have used the technology. And four, we can measure the data. So we can't measure what the device is doing. Like, we can't measure any inputs or outputs. It's just there. But what we can do is, here's where the salt water, or here's where the water has risen up the walls. here's the problem in this room. Put this device in and they measure it. They have sensors they put in the walls. They do it very scientifically. Put the device in the room, problem goes away. Now we can measure the result. What we can't measure is how the hell is it doing it. So when I see something like that, it's not an energy device as such at the moment, but we go, aha, we're stumped. Can anybody explain this? There's something happening we don't know. Science can't explain. We can't explain. The guy who invented it's got his own theories. Whether they're plausible or not, we can't say. All we can do is say, there's a result. So when I cry, show me the data, people don't have to explain where the energy is coming from. People don't have to, whether it's from the vacuum, wherever it is. We like to know where the energy is coming from. We'd like to explain it. But if you got a result that says, here is the result, then we accept it. Then it's our problem, or the scientific community's problem, or the engineer's problem, to go back and say, okay, there's irrefutable evidence that this device is doing its claim. Just because we can't explain it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It means we've got to go back and find something new here. So there's this beautiful thing happening out there that I'm very optimistic that we may discover a source or be able to generate free energy. However, we have to stay vigilant, keep the scam artists away, keep the snake oil, keep the opportunists away, and find the truth and work with the truth. If you found something like this device that works, use that as a basis to do your research. Or if we test a thermoelectric device, or we test a piezoelectric device, or we test this and we get a result, pursue that. But what we don't want to do is go down the path of following false leads, if you like, and ending up with dead ends. And there's four common things I see. One, people just haven't got the qualifications to know how to measure something. And a lot of the mistakes, I'd say the majority, are people don't know what they're looking at. They think they're seeing over unity and you're just seeing a poor measurement. I saw one research effort recently, hundreds of thousands were spent on it. At the end of the day, everybody realized it was just a measurement error, or not a measurement error, there was interference causing the measurement errors. So these things happen, both scientifically in the backyard inventor. Number two thing that happens, people keep repeating the same old things. They believe that somebody's built a working cumogen or these generators, so they try. Next thing you end up with hundreds of them, but none of them work. None of them can face any challenge to prove any viable thing. That doesn't help anybody. Whereas people were honest at the start saying, I'm seeing this, I'm not sure what I'm seeing, and then somebody comes and explains there's a measurement error or it's this or this and that, and they listen, then not those people aren't going to waste time. A recent one is what we call the quantum energy generator. A lot of hype was built up, a lot of crowdfunding, hundreds of thousands of dollars. Here it is. Here's the free plan. Save the world. We're going to save the world. We're in Korea now. We're building it. You can pay us $300 an hour for our consultancy. Give us hundreds of thousands. We're going to, you know, we're freeing the world. Here's free energy. There's one problem with that. They never had a working device that they can demonstrate. They failed now to reproduce a working device. And they're coming up with what we predicted, a whole lot of technical errors or this and that. Okay? What good does that do anybody? What good does that do anybody? It does nobody any good whatsoever. And the people who got stung for the money and end up with nothing are going to have a pretty bitter feeling. And they're not going to fund the real guys who are doing the real research. There's a lot of good guys worth backing out there doing some interesting research. These people give the whole industry a bad name. And I've seen this over and over again, and it really gets me annoyed. Anyway, off the soap for a bit. I'll slurp on my coffee. Next question.
So a few things there. I was very surprised to hear that the PAP engine had so much investment in it under the radar. The PAP engine, of course, has a mythology surrounding it where it was even demonstrated for Richard Feynman. It blew up, killed a guy, and there was a whole circus surrounding that, and people thought it just kind of disappeared. Here we have a rather large project that you mentioned that almost no one knows about. So I think it's interesting that there are actually, I wouldn't call them mega projects, but they are well-funded, well-staffed, and exploring these. They take them seriously enough to invest all that money into them. So I'm very interested to see how that turns out, because that technology has always had a certain aura surrounding it, but not much has come of it. But here we are with, you know, serious money going into it. Second, that dehumidifier technology, again, I'm not remembering it, the name of it off the top of my head either. I first heard about it from Joel Garvin and Gene Manning's book, where they profiled it. And I looked into it and I thought that was very impressive as well, where there's no input. We don't know what's going on, but it's clearly working. He's a legitimate businessman, sold many of these products, and there's no complaints about it. So like you said, that thing has been battle tested and it's still standing. So,
And the guy, I've got to tell you, the inventor is one of the most genuine, best people you can meet. I had a wonderful dinner with him. He's the sort of guy who gives you a big hug, you know. He's 100% legitimate. And I admire the guy. He's great. And he's pouring some of the energy or money or profits into the energy research side of it. So, you know, that's one that's got potential.
And someone else I think is very legitimate, but unfortunately passed away not that long ago, was Ken Shoulders. Now, he didn't have a technology per se, but he was the godfather of microelectronics. He pioneered in mass spectroscopy technologies. You know, he was a boy genius, basically, and he stumbled across these things called exotic vacuum objects. Now, he's basically the only person who ever explored that, but I thought that was a very interesting phenomenon, and I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on his work, him, and if that is possibly engineerable, or you can see any idea for how that'd be engineerable.
I agree with your comments on Ken, and he's a great pioneer, and it's a sad loss. Moray King is a big fan of Ken, and I know Moray, he's a good friend of mine. I think that's one where is definitely worth pursuing. That's one of those ones on my little, you know, top six, if you like. I've got that one in there worthwhile pursuing. And I really think there's a lot more work can be done there. And I've had some good discussions with Moray about that. It's just a matter of time and resources again. So, you know, my pecking order is 1, 2, that's probably number 6. But I hope somebody picks that one up and runs with it further. That is definitely worthwhile pursuing.
I'm a little afraid that some of his secrets died with him, because he said he barely gave interviews, but there's one or two you can find. And he said that he doesn't even publish the best stuff he found. So I find that unfortunate. But I do know he left a long paper trail, and anyone that's interested, I think QEnet has compiled all his work, and there's a couple other sites that have compiled all his papers. So if anyone's interested in looking into that, especially anyone that's technically savvy, I think they should definitely have a look.
I agree, 100%.
I guess second to last question is, to you, what does it mean to be a skeptic or a skeptical person? Because I personally distinguish between pseudo-skepticism and legitimate skepticism. So I was interested in your thoughts on that, being a person in this community that is often labeled as a skeptic.
I'm a skeptic by default. I never intended to be. I was a true believer. I thought everything everybody ever told me in my first few months of this, investigating and traveling, was real. But then when you burn through a few dollars and you suddenly realize that none of this is actually working, or there's a testing error here, you know, I won't say jaded, you just become extremely cautious. But to me, it's not about being skeptic, it's just applying scientific principles to things. I just want the truth. If something's being portrayed as free energy, or it's this or that, but they're not open to being able to quantify it, or we can't test the data, or we can't evaluate it, there's normally something smelly about it, okay? And quite often it's money, or sometimes it's just ego. I'm not out to discredit anything, but many, many times I've been called in, you know, a friend of mine, Mark, Zero Fossil Fuel is known on the internet as, he says, I'd love to have your job. And I said, I hate my job. When I say it's not my job, it's not my full-time job, but value is technology. Do you know what it's like going into a place and a guy's been working for 27 years on something, and you show that his whole premise is false because he made a measurement error? You know, you're devastating these people's beliefs. And people get very angry. People get very angry sometimes and frustrated. Well, the scam artists really hate me the most, because, you know, I just say, people, be cautious. I remember a magnetic motor scam in Australia a few years ago, and these guys took $1.5 million out of my local community, people's life savings, little mum and not qualified investors. And I warned the people, and some were my best friends, and even when it panned out that I was correct, they hated me even more because I was correct and they'd done their dough. It was somehow my fault. I'm the one that was just trying to warn them to be cautious. That's all. Ask the right questions. Can it be self-loop? Where does the energy source come from? How was it measured? Was it measured by a competent person? That's all I'm asking. I remember I flew to Africa, I've flown to Africa many times. And sometimes it's very sad. And this technology, we flew to Africa because it had a very established engineering firm, did a huge report with a credible engineer and scientist saying it's real. And we saw some videos and all the rest. I got over there with my crew. I brought people from America, I brought people from Australia. We're there evaluating it on behalf of an investor. And we get there, and within 4 hours, we found the trick. We found the scam. We found how the guy was fooling the people. And the inventor confessed everything. And that was a very sad story because they'd already given him a new car and hundreds of thousands of dollars, you know, got everybody excited. And I see this over and over again. So when you see that, and 90% of what I do, people don't know about because I'm under what they call a non-disclosure agreement. I see it time and time and time and time again. Sometimes legitimate mistakes. Sometimes it's deliberately deceiving people for monetary gain. Sometimes it's deliberately misleading people for a belief system or trying to use the free energy platform for a political or economic or religious platform. You know, it's nothing to do with the energy, it's to do with some other agenda. So call me a skeptic, but I'll just say, no, call me a scientist, or don't call me a scientist, call me an engineer that is just seeking the truth and that applies scientific principles when evaluating these technologies. If I see something, as we discussed, that I can't explain, I accept it's real, provided the data is there showing the result. And that's where all these other ones fail.
So I suppose in wrapping up a little bit, can you tell us about any new projects or announcements we can expect from you or your company in the near future?
Well, I've got a new company formed that's like, Infinergy is still the R&D company, but like I said, it's sort of got different people with different interests in it all over the, you know, different partners. We've got labs in different spots. We just launched one. Well, when I say just launched, a new one's been formed to do the commercialization of the water technology. The technology is not water powered, but everybody thinks it is. So we just run with the flow. But we're running with that. Apart from that, I am investigating two or three other very promising technologies. One is a way of producing hydrogen, and it's not the one being publicized now. This one's sort of under the radar. And what I like about it, the hydrogen is really the byproduct. It's all about commercial viability. So if you come up with an energy source, you know, at the moment, all the ways we can think of producing hydrogen costs a lot of money. This way, it makes hydrogen really, really cheap because hydrogen is really a byproduct of another commercial process. So suddenly becomes economically viable. And even if we have a free energy device, okay, it's got to stack up. I'll give you an example. You know, people think if somebody come up with a 5 kilowatt home generator, everybody buy one tomorrow and put it in the house. Maybe not. And I'll tell you why. I'll give you an example. My niece in Australia, you know, or I know people in Australia, not my niece, I'll give you another example. They have got solar electricity on their house. They took advantage of huge subsidies and all the rest when they're available. So their house is solar powered. I've got friends in America who do this. And they plug their electric car in or their, Chevy Volts or whatever. And they've already invested the capital and they've already got free energy. So if a free energy device come along, why would they go and spend more money? And this is what the free energy people got to evaluate. And even if you do come up with something, I had a friend once who had a magnetic motor, but it was going to cost hundreds of dollars a watt. Say it worked. It did work as an error, but say it did work. It's going to cost hundreds of dollars a watt. You can buy solar for a dollar a watt. It's installed now for $1.50 a watt in some countries. So whatever comes out has to be economically viable. Even the LNER, look how complex a system it is. Is that going to be viable? You think of the maintenance costs, insurance costs, installation costs, the cost of installing a device. It has to be economically viable to be worthwhile. So it's not just a matter of finding the energy source, it's making it economically viable. Where we're winning the battle in a lot of countries is solar and wind now is cheaper than coal. And also the political climate and the economic climate's changing. Some of the world banks and European banks now don't support fossil fuel projects anymore. They only support energy projects. You've got governments in the UK, conservative government, I might add, that are saying, let's create an energy revolution. So they're coming up with thousands of projects, literally, to come up so individuals can become energy independent or contribute to the energy network rather than having six corporations control it. But look at Germany, massive effort there for renewables. And people saying, oh, it's costing them a little bit more now. It is for their energy. They're paying a bit more for the energy now. What about in 10 years' time when these resources that are powering coal becomes more scarce or whatever it is becomes more scarce? It makes a huge difference, the economic viability. I think they're doing the right thing. They're investing now in the infrastructure and the systems. And in 10 years, they'll be laughing at the world. They're saying, well, we're the most economically productive country in the world or the most financially viable because we don't have to pay for our energy costs. And I'll give you an example. I'm building a internet cafe at the moment for, well, my wife's, her business, and a coffee shop and that. And we've got a program in place that within 12 months will be 100% solar power. And that adds to the bottom line, 20 or 30% to our bottom line, because our biggest cost, of course, is running computers, air conditioning and all the rest. Suddenly we think, oh, it's a big investment at the moment, but we're doing it progressively out of profits. But in 2 years or 3 years' time, nobody can touch us. We've got a huge advantage over our competition because we're not having to pay for the biggest cost, and that's electricity. So sometimes you've got to look at the long term of what's happening. Like, you can get solar now in America, no money down, depending where you live, of course, no money down, 7 years you own the system, and it gets paid for by the savings you made. I asked a lot of my American friends, why aren't you doing that now? So there's a whole melting pot of what's got to be happening. So what I think is going to move ahead, I'll give you an example. Solar in America, 15 times more was installed this year than 5 years ago. It's gaining momentum. In Australia, in some areas, 20% of all households are now solar. In South Australia, 30% of all wind energy, grid power, is now wind. So you've got different countries. The Philippines can do it. New Zealand's doing it. Norway's doing it. They're blessed with natural resources. But there's no reason. I believe the biggest change isn't waiting for the scientific breakthrough, isn't waiting for the free energy, isn't waiting for this. It's political and economic and social change. It's putting the right policies in by your governments and the people becoming aware and demanding it that will bring about change. Look in the US compared to Germany. Germany's heading towards 50% renewable energy within a decade. The US might reach 10%. What's the difference? Government policy. Look what's happening in Asia here. There's an explosion of solar and wind and geothermal and everything. Everybody's waking up to the fact that in 10, 15, maybe 20, 30 years' time, the resources are going to get bloody expensive. Energy is going to get very expensive. Those investing in renewable energy now will benefit long-term economically and environmentally. So the real change is to get active politically and bring about change.
I completely agree. And undoubtedly, we're in kind of a chaos zone. We're dealing with a lot of pressures, and I think sometimes people have to be put into a state of crisis before much changes. So even the United States, where traditionally people have been shielded from those types of realities, where we've just been externalizing all our costs to other countries, that's starting to come back to us. So I think inevitably we're going to have to embrace both these transition technologies and ultimately start giving serious credence to, again, some of these more exotic or less than mainstream ideas. So I think it's always important to keep an open mind and also to pursue stuff without being derogatory about it, because so often these alternatives are dismissed, taken off the table, and I don't think much should be taken off the table in this day and age when we're facing so many issues. So
I agree. Important thing is about funding. I said, look, I like to see a lot more funding come to free energy, different areas, and some we've mentioned. But it's very, very hard when you've got a track record that's not too good, and you've got to keep the area clean. You've got to keep the scam artists out. You've got to keep the snake oil people out. You've got to keep it clean and credible. And people are, I know many people in the free energy community who are trying to build those bridges between the academic community, between the investment community, and they're succeeding very, very slowly. But what we discovered, and a lot of other people I know discovered who've got very worthwhile projects backing. I can't talk about a lot of them, unfortunately, but there's a lot of them worthwhile backing that we discovered that we've got to do our own backing, if you like, rather than wait for the handouts, the donations, the governments, the scientists, the venture capitalists always want their pound of flesh. I can tell you, I've dealt with a few. What we're doing is we're building up environmentally friendly, legitimate projects that will make the profits that then we can fund our own research or send some of that money towards other research. So my advice to the free energy community is look for other funding models, because you ain't going to get the funding. It's just too hard. And there's too many other people trying to compete for funding at the moment, whether it's from the government or from the venture capitalists. A venture capitalist, for instance, will be happy to pay tenfold if you can demonstrate and prove something rather than invest into something that is a maybe. They rather wait till it is a definite. Then they'll invest tenfold or a hundredfold. It's really, really crazy. The risk takers aren't there anymore. I think 2008 took care of a lot of the risk takers. So our idea is build up business enterprises, build up funding models that are self-sustaining. A bit like that guy with the stuff that drives out the rooms. Oh, I forget his name. I wish I didn't. He's pouring some of his profits into legitimate energy research. And that's what you've got to do. You've got to build up enterprises, companies, corporations, or tack onto ones that have got the resources or can develop the resources to become self-funding. Then when you do eventually get some product out there that may have an impact, then, you know, that helps spurn on more funding. So it's government policy for renewable energies, and it's building up self-funding models for free energy. And the community itself, I think, is maturing rapidly. There are a lot more people getting involved, and a lot more legitimate players coming, especially like LNER and a whole lot of other areas, a lot more legitimate players coming to the table. And I think that's good. What we have to stay clear of is the sensationalism. You know, if you keep saying this is real, 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 or you go to the conspiracy side is men in black or this is that, if you deal with negativities, you're not going to get anywhere. We have to stay positive, but we also have to be grounded and deal with the realities. That is the way forward. That's my opinion. I know many disagree with me. I respect their views, but that's our path forward. That's every company I'm involved in at the moment. That's our vision and our path forward. So we're proactive bringing about change now with what's known, but we still want to invest in research of what we believe is possible.
Well, I think we certainly need a variety of voices to be heard and to be able to communicate with one another. We need a democracy of voices in any movement, because when you settle on some kind of fundamentalism, the door is closed. And like I said prior, you need to keep stuff on the table. So you always have to be careful about slipping into that kind of fundamentalism or this one track. So we always have to be dialoguing with one another. We have to be open to the idea we're not always going to agree with one another on everything. And that's okay. That's what being human is. Our perceptions are incomplete. We can't know all of reality. We can't know 100% what is the truth. So we always need feedback from one another.
Absolutely. I like to be proved wrong. I keep telling people, prove me wrong. And a lot of my friends, we have enormous debates about technology. But we don't demonize people just because you don't agree with them. We don't become this cult nature. And the free energy movement's a little bit at risk at times of becoming a bit like a cult, you know. Unless you believe in what we believe, you're out. You know, that's not right. Everybody should have their say. That's one reason we did Revolution Green. Apart from personal abuse, which we don't put up with, there's no censorship. We want everybody's views to come forward, and even ones I totally oppose or they're totally opposed to me, I always thank them. I always say, well, that's interesting. I may not agree with you, but I appreciate your effort and I appreciate your point of view. And sometimes they've badgered me, you know, they put 20 posts up, and we'll answer it to our best of our ability why we believe in what we believe. But we're not preaching it. We're just saying, well, that's our opinion, and here's the reasons why we believe in that. We just want to get to the truth. And Simon, who's a frequent commentator on our thing, he wrote it beautifully the other day. He wrote this couple of paragraphs on, it's all about trying to evaluate what's worthwhile pursuing and not wasting our small but valuable resources on what we know will be a dead end. Let's look at what's promising and follow those paths. And there's no room for cultist behaviour and demonising people. I get called all sorts of things, as you probably know. I'm the brother of Satan and all the rest. Why bother with that? There's no need for that. We should, I mean, the head of Global BM movement, or one of the key players, Jerome and I, he often says, Mark, I often disagree with you, but we both got the same motives. And that's why we've, and I consider him one of the most valuable voices out there, the great truth. And I say to him, I said, look, half of this stuff is bullshit. They said, yeah, we know, but I said, but that's okay. You know, provided we're working towards the same cause. You know, I agree with you. You've got to have this democracy and many opinions. But mine is just one of many, but I think it's an important one. I try and keep things grounded so we can pursue and bring about change that's based in reality, not based on wishful thinking.
Well, Mark Dancy, I really respect the work you do. I really appreciate your time. Thank you for being with me today.
Thank you, John. It's been a pleasure, and call me up anytime. Thanks, mate.
Will do. Take care.